two fellas walking through the woods, and they stumble across a deep hole in the ground, and they think, man, that's a deep hole. And one of them says, I wonder how deep that hole is. And the other one says, well, I took AP physics in school, and I can measure the depth of that hole. If we drop something big in there, I'll just take the time we drop it to the time it hits the ground, and we hear it hit the ground, and I'll know exactly how deep that hole is. And his buddy said, you sure you can do that? He said, I can do that. So they look around for something heavy to drop in the hole. And they're wandering around the woods, and they find a rusty anvil just laying on the ground. They thought, that's perfect. Strange to find an anvil out in the woods, but they brought it to the hole. They dropped it in the hole, and they listened for it to hit the bottom. Well, as they're listening for the anvil to hit the bottom, all of a sudden, out of the woods comes running this goat. This goat jumps right by them, jumps straight into the hole. These guys can't believe it. They're so distracted by the goat, they didn't hear the anvil hit the bottom, so they gave up, kept hiking through the woods. They hike for a while, and they hear someone yelling, Anna, Anna. And they meet a farmer and say, why are you yelling, Anna? He said, well, it's my goat, Anna. She's missing. Guy said, well, we can help you out. We saw that goat jump in a hole back there in the woods. And the farmer tells him, well, that can't be Anna. I had her tied to an anvil. Sometimes when you throw something in a hole, something else follows that you didn't intend to follow. That's kind of how I feel when I started this whole series with the Beatitudes. It's like, I think he's saying this, but the more I get into it, the more I realize I think he's saying a whole lot more than I ever understood. That's true of today's verse. Rick Davis asked me this morning, how in the world can you speak for half an hour on one short verse? There's a whole lot to say in these words that Jesus said to us in Matthew 5:4. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Some paraphrased versions read it this way, happy are you when you are sad. Now, I'm not completely comfortable with that rendering because there's a difference between mourning and sadness, but it does show the counterculture, upside-down nature of these things that Jesus said. I got a farm buddy down in Switzerland County. He would never call you a liar, but if you told him a tale that he couldn't quite get or didn't think it was real, he would always respond with the same words. He'd say, say what? Say what? And you knew he didn't believe what you were saying anytime he would say what? That might be how you feel about what Jesus is telling us today. Say what? Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. The Phillips translation, which I'm not completely happy with, but I am with this verse, says this, how happy are those who know what sorrow means, for they will be given courage and comfort. Now this verse, happier, blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted, has been translated lots of different ways. And I'm going to take the top three and explain those, but I want to at least tell you in context what I believe. I don't believe Jesus is talking about when you lose a loved one, that you're blessed when you mourn. Although, we'll talk about that, and I think you can be. I don't think he's talking about mourning the culture and society and the moral decline that we see in our world. Although, I think we can apply that as well. What I think he's talking about is a spiritual mourning where you feel so bad about how you let God down on a regular basis, and how you just continue to mess up time and time again, and how you continue to go with him with recurring sin and asking his forgiveness for the 53rd time. This verse is saying if you really will come to grips with just how unworthy you are, then that puts you in a position to be blessed by God, to appreciate grace on a level where you never have before. So again, you can take these things more than one way, which I've learned in my life, you can take everything more than one way. I talked to my mom on Labor Day. She's 82, I think, and Dad's 81. And one of the girls said something about, Mama, you're looking good. And she said she's been walking some, whatever that means. So I said, that's great, Mom. You exercise and all that. So I talked to her on Labor Day. She called me on Thursday to ask me a Bible question, which means she's in an argument with my dad and needs some always means that, and it was true. But then we get done with the Bible question, and she pretty much was with me, and we were both kind of not on the same page that Dad was. And then she says, by the way, Mark, I burned 2,000 calories today. I'm like, man, Mom, that's pretty good. And before I could talk about it much, she said, "And that's the last time I leave brownies in the oven while I nap." So you see, you can take things more than one way. So I want to talk about these three types of grieving. A natural mourning, where you grieve for someone you've lost. A societal mourning, where you grieve the changes in culture due to a loss of morality. And then with what Jesus is saying specifically, grieving over what our sins have done to God. So let's take them one at a time. First of all, every one of us in here experiences this natural mourning. Some of you are experiencing it right now. If it wasn't so private, I would read you the text that I got this morning about 5:30 from Phyllis Wampler, Norm's wife. It's a book, but man, she says so many good things, but I'll respect her privacy. She's mourning right now, as many of us have, are, or will be. I love reading the book of James. I've tried to memorize chunks of it. At one point in my ministry, I had all five chapters memorized and could even tell you which verse was which. That has since left me, but I've been in James 4 this week. You are a mist that appears for a little while, then vanishes. That's your life, just a mist. And I don't know how many funerals I've done through the years. Not as many funerals as I have weddings, but I've done enough to see funerals that were packed with people who cared, like the funeral of John Williams a few weeks ago. And I've done funerals where nobody showed up. I mean, nobody. It was me and the person horizontal. And that was it. And it hit me how sad that is, that we could have a service after someone has lived their life and nobody cares, nobody shows up, nobody hurts, and nobody mourns. So in that context, we could say it like this: blessed are you when you have someone to mourn. There were different groups through the years that taught people to stay away from relationships. They say, don't get too close, don't rely on anyone, avoid love at any cost. And their teaching was, if you avoid love at any cost, you avoid hurt and pain. In other words, if I don't get close to you, you die, so what? That was the teaching. They would say the risk of being hurt is not worth the reward of being loved. How do you feel about that? I don't want to live my life that way. I don't want to live that way. So we just won't get close. We won't form a relationship. And then when you die, I won't feel the pain from that loss. It doesn't make any sense at all to me. I remember when Jared was, I think he was 6. He had a lizard he was pretty fond of. I was cool with him having a pet lizard. He called him MJ because Michael Jordan was his favorite ball player at the time. And one day he made the mistake of putting MJ under a glass container and left him out in the yard, and it was July and it got 90 that day. So when he gets home, the summer heat had fried that poor little fella, and there's not much call for fried lizard unless you're eating at Asian Pearl. So we got a shovel and we buried MJ, and Jared was pretty torn up about it. He was mourning. He really was. That lasted 2 hours, because 2 hours later, after burying that little lizard, here he comes around the corner of the house, and he had dug up MJ's corpse, and he's got him on a tennis racket, and he's bouncing him up and down like this. So he comes around, and some of his buddies are there, and I'm standing there, and he says, "Dad, what's this?" And he smacks that dude. Wait, you'd have been proud, Dave Adams. It was a good forehand, straight up into the air. And it hit me even then, and I went in the house and I wrote it down. The progression that I had just witnessed from heartfelt agony to Andre Agassi in 2 hours. I've always leaned on 1 Thessalonians 4. Brothers, we do not want you to be ignorant about those who fall asleep or to grieve like the rest of men who have no hope. Leave that up for a minute, Jamie. What's the opposite of being ignorant? Being informed, right? So what Paul is saying is, this is information that you need. Information you need, and we do need it. I've heard people use this verse to say we're not supposed to grieve. It's saying the very opposite of that. It's informing you that if you're a believer, here's how you should grieve. This verse explains why the believer knows how to die better than the unbeliever does. With all the people in this place today, we got a lot of differences, man. I'm looking around. Y'all don't dress the same. You don't like the same kinds of music. I know that for a fact. Some of you like more jokes in sermons. Some of you think there's too many. We're all different. Some like sports. The NFL kicks off today. Some could care less. I told you before, the Bengals start today, and I'm going to use six Bengals as my pallbearers when I die so they can let me down one more time. Some of you like classical music. Some of you like a banjo and a fiddle. My little cousin Angel used to tell us when she was little she was going to grow up and dance in the ballet. Well, we knew she meant ballet, and we concluded if you can't say it, you can't dance in it. I asked my bluegrass boys yesterday if they knew what you call hee-haw reruns where I'm from, documentaries. It was attributed to me an email here a few weeks ago, and many of you got it. It was a scam. It wasn't me. And Jamie and Priscilla fielded, just 100 calls about, is this real? Is this Mark? And it was supposedly me. Many of you got this, asking you to get a Target gift card of $500 and give it to me because I was giving some COVID relief to some people. But it ain't funny to be scammed like that. But the funny part was, almost all of you all, to a man and a woman, concluded it wasn't me for the same reason. And I'll just quote Dan Bortner on this because the rest of you agreed. Mark, I knew it wasn't you because there wasn't any Vivi speak in it. That's the same as saying you knew it wasn't me because it was proper English. Well, I'm starting to get a complex. I'm losing my identity. They had a Mark Fugate lookalike contest in Vivi. I paid $50 and entered and finished third. Some of us here speak proper English. Some of us ain't ever gonna. Some here drive Fords. Some of us drive Chevys. Some like to dress up. Some like to dress down. Some prefer health food for breakfast. Others prefer the breakfast of champions, Mountain Dews and Ho-Hos. We could go row to row, difference after difference. I'm thankful that there's a universal equalizer. I am. I'm thankful there's a common denominator that should keep us on level ground. If the Lord doesn't come back soon, death is beyond escape. And for someone who is in Jesus, while there is hurt from the separation, death can be faced with hope, and death can be faced with anticipation, and death can be faced with assurance, and death can be faced with joy. We die better than people who don't know Jesus. And we're supposed to. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. I was called to Deaconess Hospital. It's right on the campus of the University of Cincinnati years ago. Chester Williams was in his last day. They didn't think he'd make it through the night. So some church folk went. I went. We're in Chester's room preparing for him to go be with the Lord. And I hear this wailing going on down the hallway. I mean, just rip your heart out wailing. So I told our folk, I'm going to go see who it is and see if I can help. So I walked down just a few doors down from Chester's room. These people, I mean, they've lost it. And I said, hey, I'm not meaning to interrupt, and I know you don't know me, but I was down the hallway and I heard, and I can tell you're hurting, and I'd love to pray with you all. They wanted no part of that and no part of me. First comment was, if there even is a God, we wouldn't be in this situation. So they politely invited me to leave. And I did. I prayed for them anyway on my way out the door, but I left. And I go back to Chester's room. And right as I'm walking in, they'd already started a song. And it was an old hymn that I knew. I don't know how many of you know it. The verse says this. This is what they were singing. And they had some people from the church that could harmonize. It was like, I am going to a city where the streets with gold are laid, where the tree of life is blooming and the roses never fade. So we got singing going on. And just a few yards away, there is uncontrollable and unconsolable grief. I mean, just a few yards from door to door, they might as well have been worlds apart. We know how to die better. We don't grieve like the rest of men who have no hope. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. There's a societal mourning as well, and I'm there now. The mourning that we experience when society loses its morality, where's the blessing in that? How's there any blessing that comes from the moral decay that we see in our lifetime? I've always thought that those who talked about the good old days just had a bad old memory. But an honest assessment of where we are as a society would have to lead you to the conclusion that we have lost our way, right? I now have 4 grandchildren. 4. And I know you're thinking, that's amazing for a guy 49 to have 4 grandchildren. And it would be amazing. And I can totally relate to what Paul Harvey said years ago. We tried to make things better for our kids and ended up making them worse. For my grandchildren, I want better. I'd really like for them to know about hand-me-down clothes and homemade ice cream and leftover meatloaf. I really would. I'd hope they'd learn humility by surviving failure and they'd learn to be honest when no one is looking. I hope they learn to make their bed, mow the lawn, wash the car, be good if they could see a calf being born, or have a good friend with them if they have to put the dog to sleep. I hope they get a black eye fighting for something they believe in. I hope you skin your knee climbing a mountain or burn your hand on the stove. I hope my grandchildren stick their tongues to a frozen flagpole at least one time in their lives. Anybody with me? I've done that. I've done it twice. That puts me in a special category right there. Because you do it once, you are an adventurer. You do it twice, you're an idiot. I hope they take time to sit on the porch with grandma and grandpa. Hope they go fishing. Hope they have tough times and disappointment, hard work and happiness. These are the things I want for my grandchildren. And if you were to ever research why historians believe that nations fall, you look at all the great nations in history that we thought would conquer the world and be there forever, and all of them that fell. Here's the reasons that historians give you for their fall: disease, climate change, demographics, political corruption, mass immigration, economic stagnation, inferior technology, and foreign invasion. That's the conclusion arrived at by most historians. Man, are they missing the forest for the trees? There's no mention of failed morals. So let me compare that list to something Edward Gibbon wrote a year before the U.S. Constitution was ratified. He published the history of the rise and fall of the Roman Empire. And he lists the reasons for their fall. And he concludes that any group of people or society that falls, falls because of these reasons. So let me show you that list again. The historians say it's disease, climate change, demographics, political corruption, mass immigration, economic stagnation, inferior technology, foreign invasion. Here's what Gibbons wrote before the Constitution was ratified. Here's why nations break down according to him. Go ahead, Jamie, flip it over. The breakdown of the family, increased taxation, insatiable craving for pleasure, the decay of religion, and the loss of individual morality. And he's right. And in the sexual revolution of the 1960s, I still have a quote in my files from a justice of the Supreme Court who said, "It is utterly impossible to define character." Well, that's a radical departure from what previous generations believed, because they knew what character was, and so do we. It means honoring your parents and not killing anyone and not stealing from anyone and telling the truth. I agree with what Thomas Jefferson said. The Ten Commandments and the Sermon on the Mount contain my religion. Governmental dependency has created cracks in the foundation. According to the Congressional Budget Office, rising entitlement spending and interest on the national debt will consume 99% of all the tax revenues that are received in the next 5 years. And history teaches us that nations fall when the cost of paying their debt exceeds the cost of defending their borders. That's where we're at. It was true of Rome. It was true of the Soviet Union. It will be true of the United States of America. Other things have contributed to where we are. Homosexuality was being less viewed as a sin and more viewed as a right. Without masculine fathers, without feminine mothers to teach children about the roles of sex in a marriage, gender confusion is now a real thing and a new era of redefining marriage and family. And rather than accepting the notion that society is falling short of the biblical standard, all we have to do to make ourselves feel better is change the standard. And so our society rejects the thought of cause and effect. Even though we know cause and effect is a real thing, it's a biblical thing, not anymore. Well, it's still true. Romans 1:18 says, "For the wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men." 2 Timothy 3 says, "In the last days, people will love only themselves and their money. They will be boastful and proud, scoffing at God and disobedient to their parents." 2 Chronicles 7:14 is still true. "If my people who are called by my name will humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, I will hear from heaven and forgive their sin and I will heal their land." When I see what's happening in this country, it makes me want to mourn. It does. There's a scripture I want to mention to you that could be part of a Bible trivia game. What's the shortest verse in the Bible? Jesus wept. Anybody know how many times Jesus wept in the Bible? Twice. The time you're talking about, when Lazarus died, so he wept over a person, but the second time he wept over a place. It's found in Luke 19:41. As he approached Jerusalem and saw the city, he wept over it. Now the context is Jesus, before his triumphal entry, knowing, okay, they're going to praise me on Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, and then they're going to nail me to the cross come Friday, and that's what he was weeping over. When I reflect on our world and how everybody just goes about their business as if it will always be this way, never considering that just like Jesus came into Jerusalem, Jesus is going to come into our world, it's truly sad, isn't it, to see such a lack of preparation and readiness? To see Christian people who are living lives as if that event is never going to happen? Sad. We need to be more urgent and evangelistic in our ministry. My dad said years ago, man, it was such a good quote. He said, "To be winners of souls, we have to be weepers of souls." It has to break our heart, the state of affairs, before we do anything about it. So, with that being said, where's the blessing in that kind of mourning? Me mourning the state of affairs in our country. Where's the blessing there? Well, I'll tell you where the blessing is. This world is not my home. I'm just a passing through. The blessing is, I'm getting away from this place someday. That's the blessing. If I'm faithful to God, I will mourn the state of affairs that this world is in, but I will be comforted by the reality of a new place. A new place that doesn't look like the place I'm getting away from. You know, I've learned enough about God to know two things for sure. I can trust Him. And He'll do things His way, whether I understand it or not. I look back at so many answered prayers, and I'm like, "Lord, here's how I see this happening." And it happened, but it sure wasn't the way I saw it happening. Which reminded me when I was preparing this of the couple. They're in their 60s, and they're celebrating their 40th wedding anniversary. They're walking on the beach when both of them fall into this big hole, just like Anna the goat did. And they can't get out. And so they pray, "Lord, get us out of this hole." Well, God is impressed by their faith and audibly speaks to them and says, "I hear you, and because of your faith, I'm going to get you out of the hole, but not only that, I'm going to grant each of you a wish." And so He gets them out of the hole, and He says to the woman, the Lord says, "What's your wish?" She said, "I've always wanted to travel the world," and poof, just like that, airline tickets in her hand, and a helicopter lands on the beach to take her to the airport so she can fly and travel the world. And then the Lord speaks to the man and says, "What's your wish?" And the man says, "I wish I had a wife 30 years younger than me." And poof, he was 90. Doesn't always go the way you think it's going to. My uncle, his catchphrase that he would, "Well, every now and then, I mean, he said that, my growing up, yeah, every now and then. I kind of like that phrase because I think Christians are now and then people. Heaven is real. And every time I mourn the world I live in now, I'm comforted by the truth of the world to come then. Every time I cry now, I come to realize I'll never cry then. Every time I say goodbye now, I come to realize I'll never say goodbye then. Every time I see someone abused now, I come to realize I'll never see anyone abused then. Every time I see someone gripped by addiction now, I come to realize I'll never see them chained by addiction then. Every time I see someone in pain now, the realization hits me, I'll never see them in pain then. Every time I hear a sad, depressing, heartbreaking story now, I come to realize I'll never hear another one of those stories then. I'm a now and then kind of guy. I'm living here now, and it makes me sad to see what's happening. But then, I will be comforted because blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Now, I went a long way around the barn to get to the end because here's exactly what Jesus was saying, and I'll close with this. There's a spiritual mourning that we experience when we lose our pride. These Beatitudes follow a pattern. It's like you go from this one to this one, and it makes sense because there's a bridge between each of these. And the thought here is not that you lay down in bed at night and you're so eaten up by guilt that you can't sleep night after night, but it's to take an honest look at who we are and what we bring to the table. Reminds me of my buddy Joe Elliott, him and his wife Betty, good people, but man, do they dog each other. They fight all the time. They don't care if they're with you at church or at home. They're going at it, one right after the other. They just can't get along. And Joe said he was looking in the mirror in their bedroom, and he said to his wife Betty, he said, "Honey, when I look in the mirror, all I see is a fat, ugly, wrinkly, balding old man. I'd really like for you to say something nice to me." And Betty said, "Well, your eyesight is perfect." Well, I want you to take a good look in the mirror this morning. And I'm not talking about glass. I'm talking about the Word of God. And when you do that, it will reveal exactly where you are. Now, show of hands. If you have ever asked God to forgive you for something that you had already asked Him to forgive you for before, keep them up. Okay, good, you're with me. Now, if you have ever asked God more than 5 times to forgive you something that you've already asked Him to forgive you for before, that's right. Now, I won't go higher than 5 or it will depress me. We all have recurring sin. So people will ask the preachers, Charlie, me and you, they will ask us, will God continue to forgive? You know, I've been here before, the same place. It's the 10th time in 3 months. Will He continue to forgive? I have two answers to that, or one answer that's twofold. Yes, let me start with that. He will. But understand this, the true believer who has placed his faith in God will grow more and more uncomfortable with the situation where he keeps coming back to God and having to say, "I'm sorry," for the same thing. It's something you can't live with at some point. It should bother you. It should bring you to tears. It should be like, "Man, I can't believe I did this again. I'm just sorry. Just sorry." Grow uncomfortable with it. Bring tears to your eyes when you realize how weak you are and how forgiving He is. Should be better than this, right? I used to sing a chorus sitting on the back porch with my guitar that said, "Does He still feel the nails every time I fail? Can He hear the crowd cry, 'Crucify again?' Am I causing Him pain? Then I know I got to change. I just can't bear the thought of hurting Him." We all have issues that are repeated and need to go to the Father each time. But before that shame and guilt can have their way with me, I need to be reminded that the Lord brings me comfort because he says his mercies are new every morning. So it brings me to this conclusion. It's not about me and how I feel. It's about him and what he's going to do. And that beatitude is the one that clearly lets me know that the comfort he promises that I need, he's going to bring it because I'm unworthy. The thing about God's grace is it doesn't just respond to the needs that come to it. It seeks out the needs that would go unmet if it wasn't for his grace. I got a lot of preacher friends through the years, and there's a guy in Alexandria, Kentucky. His name is Carl. He's probably not preaching now. He's got to be in his 80s now. Such a good man. He preached in the church. Alexandria, Kentucky ain't too far from Indiana. You can be there about 35 minutes across the bridge. He went to the home of a family that just started attending his church. They had a new baby. And so he wanted to go and celebrate with the family. They were having some other church people there, and Carl went. And this family also had a little girl who was, I think, 4 years old at the time Carl visited. So he goes, and all these people are partying and eating snacks and passing the new baby around and making over the baby. And Carl sees the little girl in the corner and can tell she's kind of dejected. I mean, it's always been her till now. She's jealous. And she's not fussing about it, but he can tell just based on her demeanor, she's not happy about all this recognition for her little sister. So he's a sensitive kind of guy, Carl is, and I appreciate that about him. So he went to that little girl, and he got down on his knees to talk to her, and he told her how special she is for being a big sister and how important that job is. And she asked him if she could show him her favorite doll. And Carl said, well, how many dolls do you have? Well, she had dozens of them in her room. And said, but one of them's my favorite. He said, I'd love to see your favorite doll. She goes up, comes back with a Raggedy Ann doll. And raggedy was the key word, man. It was dirty. It had been wore down. The stuffing is coming out of the back. It is not the prettiest doll that she had up in the room. So Carl asked her, why is that one your favorite? And that little girl's answer, because no one else would ever make that doll their favorite. And then she said, if I didn't love her, then who would? And Carl leaned down and pointed over to the new baby and whispered to that little girl, don't tell your sister, but you're my favorite. Now listen, my beat up, wore down, messed over, stuffing coming out, falling apart church family, you are God's favorite. And if he didn't love us the way he does, somebody tell me who would. And the best way to experience that love and that grace and that mercy is to be honest about who we are, what we've done, and what we have to offer. So here's the bottom line. To get to him and all he has to offer, I have to get to the end of me. And I can do that because blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. Amen.